Mrs. Thatcher to speak to us this evening, and thank you for keeping an engagement that you made so long ago. And we are proud, too, that our member, Jim Spicer, had the foresight last summer to ask Mrs. Thatcher to come to West Dorset in the spring. Since Mrs. Thatcher's election as party leader, we had to make different arrangements for the hall. And we have come here and done the very best we can to fit everybody in. I know it is not an ideal arrangement. We have some people in another room, and we have some people behind us. Are you all right? We have done the very best that we can manage. I welcome you all, particularly Simon Wingfield Digby, whom we are very pleased to have with us this evening.
Lost.
They're up the back, they're up there.
And their daughter, Alison, who was Mrs. Thatcher's secretary. And I believe it was Alison's idea that Mrs. Thatcher should come to West Dorset. And I hope you will tell Alison how very thrilled we are that this evening is really happening. I would also like to welcome some representatives from neighbouring constituencies. Mrs. Thatcher, last week when you were in Scotland, you were wearing some white heather for good luck. Tonight, may I give you this, grown by an orchid specialist in West Dorset. And it comes to you with our very best wishes for good health and stamina for this.
Thank you.
You didn't let me finish my sentence. For this terrific job that she has undertaken to do. And now I'm going to ask our member, Jim Spicer, to introduce our speaker, the Right Honourable Margaret Thatcher, leader of the Conservative Party.
Madam Chairman, Mrs. Thatcher, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure, Madam Chairman, you won't mind if I first of all say a word to those poor people incarcerated in another hall away from here, and apologize to them, as I know it's already been done, but we did all in our power to waive the provisions that the fire authorities put on this hall only on Thursday afternoon. It was quite impossible. And certainly immediately after this meeting, I know they've been told this, but I'm sure I can speak for Mrs. Thatcher. She will be coming over to see you, but I'm speaking to them at the moment, not to anyone on this board. Can I first of all say, Madam Chairman, and echo what you said, that it is indeed a very great honour to have a leader of the opposition in this constituency. Somebody, I can't quite remember who it was, said once that a week was a very long time in politics. And exactly a week ago tonight, or all day on the Friday, Mrs. Thatcher was being battered and bashed in shopping precincts in Edinburgh, first of all, and then receiving an overwhelming, enthusiastic reception in Glasgow. But all I can say to her is that, of course, it's nice to get that in Glasgow and Edinburgh. But my goodness, it's much more important to get it from the rural heartland of England. And we really do here represent that heartland. And we are indeed proud that the very first occasion on which you are visiting any rural constituency is to this constituency and to Bevanstone particularly. I went into Dorchester today to get some petrol. And the petrol attendant said to me, I've always been a sort of semi-socialist, halfway Tory in a good year. And my wife has always been a socialist. But he said, certainly we are both solid Tories now. Firstly, because Mrs. Thatcher is the leader of the Conservative Party, and secondly, that she has honoured not a pledge, but a promise to come here. Because I can honestly say tonight that there are very few people who, picking up the diary of the leader of the Conservative Party, as she did 2 weeks ago, would still honour a promise to come here tonight. If I may, I want to give you three very quick little caveats about Mrs. Thatcher. The first one was about 18 months ago, and in the afternoon of a very nasty day, her son promised to have the car back for her and didn't. And so she had to travel up to Oxford by car after a full day at the Ministry of Education. And there she dealt very adequately with 350 or 400 European women. And that's a pretty formidable audience for anyone. She then had to talk to them after dinner, and at 11:30 at night, we drove back to London, and I luckily was there with a car. And we arrived back at her house at 1:30 in the morning. And as we opened the door, there was her dispatch box. And she said, oh good, it's not a very heavy one tonight. And she was leaving the next morning at 8:00 to go somewhere else in the morning. Now that is stamina of a very high order indeed. The second little cameo is a picture in the last summer, one of the few fine days we had. And there was a tiny little MGTC 1946 type model that appeared with two young people in the front into the House of Commons car park with Mrs. Thatcher sitting up on the back of the MG and looking as happy as the days are long. And that is a relaxed attitude which we can all admire. And the third, which runs into a fourth, is this: that just after Mrs. Thatcher said that she would stand for the leadership, I remember just passing her briefly and saying, well done for putting your hat in the ring. And she said, well, someone had to do it, because otherwise it would have been a farce. And that is a very courageous act for anyone. And we all admired her for doing that. And we all, I'm sure, are delighted with the result. And then the final thing, which leads on from that, the very next day, sitting in the Royal Albert Hall, and you know what a ghastly place that is, you go right up. And I was with right in the back row, right at the very top, the Institute of Directors, about 5,000 or 6,000 of them. And there, right down, miles away, there's this tiny figure holding an audience of 5,000 or 6,000 people. Now, she did that, and she did it wonderfully well. She is doing that now for the Tory Party. It has been a bad year for the Tory Party, and suddenly in Parliament and out of Parliament, there is a new feeling. Not in the Tory party only, but in this country. A breath of fresh air that we've long needed. And I think now is the time when we push behind us all the unhappiness of that February election, which was compounded by that October election, and renew ourselves with a new leadership determined to see the end of socialism in this country. Mrs. Thatcher, thank you so much for coming to visit us tonight. We look forward very much to hearing your heartfelt words, which I'm sure you're going to give us in full measure.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Spicer, ladies and gentlemen, you're very, very kind to me. After all, I accepted an invitation here as only me. It was quite by accident, and the cooperation of about 160 chaps on the Conservative benches at the right time, that I became leader of the opposition. And I'm very happy indeed that I'm able to fulfill this engagement this evening. And only too sorry that Alison isn't with us. Alison can't have the message very quickly, I'm afraid, because I think she's gone off to the Far East, but I hope will eventually come back and join me once again at the House of Commons. Now, Jim has given me a wonderful write-up of the number of occasions when he and I have been in and out of the House of Commons, And I confess I was a little bit worried just before I came tonight, because when you use that phrase, threw her hat into the ring, I all of a sudden wondered if this was a hatty place. Because I came down without a hat, and I was greatly reassured when I was told, no, this wouldn't be a hatty meeting. So that set my mind at rest on one thing right from the start. Now the second thing is this, we shall be along to the overflow. And I notice one great difference between being an ordinary member of parliament and a leader of the opposition. When you're leader of the opposition, you get overflows. Ordinary members of parliament don't get overflows, and one will have to be careful not to get a swelled head because of that. But we'll be along to see the overflow later. Now, I wanted to talk to you about one or two matters affecting the rural countryside, and then about one or two things which fundamentally affect us all as British people wherever we live. Now, if you look at a map of England on which each constituency has been painted with the colour of the party that represents it in Parliament, you make the surprising discovery that almost the whole map has been painted blue. There are patches of red around the cities, but the broad acres on which the food is grown that supports the urban millions are traditional Tory country. Now that's a loyalty which I hope no Conservative leader will ever take for granted. I certainly shan't. Because a party that has always had deep roots in the countryside must continue to earn that loyalty. And however much farmers may grumble at us when we're in office, and they do grumble, even at Tory governments, I have a brother-in-law and sister who are farmers, and I'm kept very much in touch with the problems of the farming industry. The fact remains that we've served British agriculture better than a wholly urban party can ever do. In the years before 1970, a Labour government brought many British farmers to the verge of bankruptcy. And in the past year, livestock producers and dairy farmers have been no better treated. For the first time, we are actually beginning to see a decline, not only in present output, but in provision for the future. They say, of course, we should be thankful for small mercies. And the latest price review may just prevent a bad situation from becoming even worse. I rather doubt it. But I can't see it as any kind of a sound foundation for that sustained expansion of production that we need and that can only be based on adequate returns and confidence in the future. Madam Chairman, consumer food subsidies are no answer to the real problem. They really conceal reality and blur the issue. We know that our farmers and farm workers can do the job if they are given the right encouragement. Because the industry's record since the war really has been little short of amazing. In fact, it's no exaggeration to say that if British manufacturing industry had increased its productivity at anything like the rate of British agriculture, we should be a very prosperous country indeed, with no balance of payments problem at all. And what a wonderful bonus that would be for us all. But to produce more food from our own fertile acres is more than an economic necessity. It's a moral obligation as well. Because this is one field in which self-interest and altruism go hand in hand. Of course we need to reduce our imports for balance of payments reasons. But when millions of people in the underdeveloped countries are suffering from malnutrition or facing starvation, We've an absolute duty to reduce our own demands on the food resources of the outside world. And that's another reason for growing as much as we can in this country. But a well-balanced economy means, too, a well-balanced society. We've got to have it balanced between the needs of the country and the needs of the town. Balanced between governments and the needs of citizens. For the interdependence of town and countryside is a real thing, and we must keep the balance right. Britain's countryside is not just something for townspeople to build on and picnic in. It's an area in which other people live and work and cherish their own values and way of life. And it must flourish if Britain as a whole is to flourish. A well-balanced society. It's very easy to say, it's very difficult to achieve. But it's only in a well-balanced society in which no single institution or group of people is too large or too powerful that everyone can feel happy and secure. Because excessive power, selfishly or irresponsibly used by any sectional interest, threatens the freedom and prosperity of everyone. But a proper balance of power, and that includes the second kind of balance, a proper balance of property and influence, that must be the aim of true statesmanship. And the first essential for that is a proper balance between the power of the state and the freedom and aspirations of the individual citizen. Let me repeat something I wrote recently in a newspaper article. It's not the business of politicians to try to please everyone. That's impossible. But it is our business to try to do justice to everyone. And this involves doing justice to the strong, the able, the enterprising, and the thrifty, as well as to the weak and the unfortunate. No more than justice, but certainly no less. How else can a struggling country survive? Wealth has to be created as well as shared. And it's not created by the state, by public corporations, or by the welfare services. It's created by the vision, the ideas, the hard work, and the savings, and yes, the capital, of men and women in industry, in commerce, and the land. You need the capital and savings of the people invested in industry, in commerce, and in the land to produce the maximum of which we are capable. And I wonder, is this something that Mr. Healy, Mr. Benn, and Mr. Foote can't see? And if they can't see it because of their ideological blinkers, they must be guilty of foolish and dangerous bigotry. But if they can see it, the necessity to create before you can distribute, if they can see it, but are determined nevertheless to upset the balance of society and destroy the springs of enterprise, then they're vindictive as well as dangerous. Madam Chairman, anyone with common sense can see the dangers. And it is to the common sense of the great majority of British people that we must appeal if we're to unite the country in time for it to save itself. Common sense tells us that we really can't go on for long consuming more than we produce, or being paid more in real terms for producing no more. It tells us, too, that the process of readjustment can't be entirely painless, in the short run at least, for everyone. There is absolutely no salvation in the encroaching power of the state, stultifying initiative, and expensively undertaking unnecessary responsibilities. Let us aim not just to halt the advance of the state, but to reverse it. We need less state interference, not more. If we could restore common sense as well as justice to our taxation and welfare systems, to say nothing of education, what a sigh of relief there would be, and what a load of resentments would be lifted. Now this week, as you probably read in your papers in the House of Commons, we had quite a row over the latest provision of the Labour government. I think it's the first time in my lifetime in Parliament when I've been able to ask this question. Now we're finishing this finance bill, when are we having the next budget? Now you perhaps might not see the significance of that. Jim's seen it, Simon Woodfield Digby has seen it, and Hinch has seen it. We only normally have one budget a year. Budgets sometimes get incorporated in finance bills, so the finance bill follows the budget. This year we've had three budgets. We're on our second finance bill. We haven't finished the results of the last budget yet, and we're thinking about the next one. And it's the first time in my lifetime in Parliament, and I've been there 15 years, and Simon had been there a lot longer, when you're on one budget still, you've been able to ask, and when is the next one? Now that, of course, represents, I think, some of the financial mismanagement of a Labour government. Because what really happened was we had to have the November budget because of what they took away that they shouldn't have taken away in March. And what happened then was, and you and I have been talking about creating wealth before distributing it, they took so much out of industry in the way of taxation that industry found itself in difficulties for cash to pay the men on Fridays and at the end of the month. And so therefore, we had to have a November budget to try to put back something in that they should never have taken out. Now, of course, it's anyone's guess about what's going to happen in the next budget after Easter. But this present finance bill, and we're going to spend 5 days on it next week and the week after, has done more than that. It's done much more damage than that. And as I went round in the village hall this afternoon, a number of you were talking to me about it. First, we know full well that we can't carry on without the savings of the people. If you want investment, whether in farming or in commerce or in industry, someone's got to save the money to invest it. Instead of spending it, they've got to save it. And what does this budget or this finance bill do about savings? Well, again, you mentioned it to me in the village hall this afternoon. Although we need savings, it increases the taxation upon savings. And I know that a number of you whose incomes have dwindled because of the effects of inflation will also have suffered the further extra dwindling which we're getting from the extra surtax on savings income which is imposed in the November finance bill. So those who save have suffered twice under socialism. First, their savings have been eaten up in real terms because of inflation. Secondly, the reduced amount has had heavier tax upon it, and therefore it's been reduced yet again. Well, to us, if we apply our test of common sense, that seems absolutely absurd. If you want to encourage savings, to do everything in your finance bill to discourage them. And we, the Conservatives, on your behalf, have opposed that very vigorously. But that's not the end of this finance bill. It has a new tax in it. And never be misled by long names. As you know, it's called the capital transfer tax, but it's a new, very heavy tax. And if it goes through as it is, it will change the face of Britain adversely within one generation. Because it has a highly damaging effect on three things which are vital to the whole British economy. on farming, on forestry, and on small businesses. Again, we come back to what I was saying in the earlier part of my speech. We need the food production from farms, we need a flourishing commerce, we need a flourishing industry. We also happen to need a great deal of forestry and cut timber. Because you remember when Mr. Wilson came back from Russia with that agreement to lend the Russians £1,000,000,000 at a low rate of interest, which we haven't got. Borrowing it at 15% to lend it back at about 7, it's thought 7 or 8%. What he didn't say, is what he did in the House of Commons, do him justice, is that we in fact import about £100,000,000 worth of timber per year from the Soviet Union. So we need all the timber we can get from our own forestry. And the capital transfer tax was damaging forestry by imposing taxation before the timber was cut, and we fought that and got some amendments. It's imposing very heavy taxation on agriculture. We fought that and got some reliefs, but not enough. There are still very grave problems with those who are tenant farmers and a query about how far that system is likely to flourish and continue if this tax goes through. And then, of course, there is the third point about small businesses. Well, now, small businesses provide about 1 in 4 of the jobs in this country. Now, that's very important, particularly when it's difficult to get jobs. And it is getting more difficult to get jobs. 1 in 4. And what happens is that they put on again the biggest tax that small businesses have ever had to encounter when the business is passed over from one generation to another. And it is very doubtful whether we shall have businesses, family businesses, being built up generation after generation and being passed from one generation to another. Indeed, in the House, I called it the one generation society. And I think that would be a great tragedy for Britain if you could not, in fact, build for the future and build for your own families. It's always seemed to me to be not only praiseworthy, but highly laudable to want to do better by your own family and your own children. So there are really 3 ways in which the capital transfer tax is highly damaging on farming, on forestry, and on small businesses. And that is why we shall fight it day in and night out next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and we shall be seeing a great deal of one another, members of Parliament, in the House of Commons next week, fighting on your behalf against this tax. And of course, it's a tax which is put on by a government that was returned by less than 40% of the votes. The excuse for it is that it's going to redistribute wealth. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. What it's going to do is concentrate wealth in the hands of the state, as every tax does, taking it away from the citizen. And therefore it's going to upset the other balance that I spoke about. Because we, the Conservatives, stand for keeping private property in the hands of the people, individual people, and hoping to get it more widely distributed genuinely among individual people. It's not distributing anything to tax it and put it all into the hands of the state. So that's this finance bill. Heaven knows what the next one will contain. And added to that, of course, is the fifth thing. There was the savings, the capital transfer tax with its 3 points, and the fifth thing, which is affecting us all very adversely indeed, or many of us, and that is the extra tax on the self-employed through the national insurance contribution. Now, again, at a time when you need as many jobs as possible, you'd have thought it advisable to look after the self-employed, who often provide not only jobs for themselves, but jobs for others. It's always the independent who are struck at by a socialist government. Those who exercise initiative and independence and save, who are in fact very badly affected. And now we shall in fact be fighting hard on your behalf on those things on this last November's finance bill, which must be through by March the 14th. Now, we shall fight on that and on many other fronts. And I believe that at the next election, we can win. Earlier in my brief life so far as leader of the opposition, I made a speech round the good old-fashioned text. It's always as well to have a text, even if it's in a speech. Without vision, the people will perish. Where there is no vision, the people will perish. Within a few days, one of the commentators had got at me and concluded an article about me with these words: "The art of political survival is to deal with the facts as they are and not to dream dreams." I thought he must have been as dry as dust to write that. But I know what he meant. I think I'm a practical politician. Most housewives are. We have to be. We've no choice. And I try to get my facts right. Indeed, those selfsame commentators, when I've turned up in the House of Commons with a stack of documents, with every single fact documented, have said she bothers too much about the fact, she's legalistic. Well, never mind. But never to dream dreams or to have a vision of the future. What a depressing thought. That's the fate of bureaucrats. It's not the inspiration of a statesman. Did Disraeli never dream dreams? Did Winston Churchill never dream dreams of a future? Of course they did. And I say again, give us your support, and we will try and implement the vision of the future. Of course we'll deal with the facts as they are, but perhaps we'll make some dreams of a Great Britain come true as well.
Mrs. Thatcher is prepared to answer questions. I think you have been warned about this. Then there is a microphone. Somebody down here has a microphone?
I do not.
Thank you. Anybody would like to come up and use the microphone so that everybody can hear the question?
Yes. I'll do it at the end.
I got it back down.
Put the individual with his back against a rather strong wall.
close again.
Shall I answer as we go along? I think there is a good case for this, but the problem in this country has been, as parliamentarians know, that any parliament can upset what any previous parliament did. And really, therefore, the only true safeguard is to return parties to parliament which believe in those things and which are prepared to protect them. And this means that Conservative members of parliament have got to put very squarely before the people the issues at each election and to show how much those things of which Lord Renfrew has spoke could be endangered. Now, let's see what he spoke about in particular as an illustration. First, the sanctity of the home, and he referred to fiscal legislation and VAT. Bad as that is, it's nothing like as bad as one of the provisions in the schedules to the present finance bill, which gives, under certain circumstances, to certain companies even increased powers of entry beyond those which can be used now over VAT. And I heard that early morning programme on the radio, and having been dealing in the previous week with the extra powers of entry, I thought, well, if people only knew what the Labour government is providing for now, they wouldn't like it. That's in Schedule 4, and that will come up next week. That again needs to be thrown up, and indeed thrown out. Now, fiscal legislation, I'm afraid there is a habit almost on the part of the Labour government to have retrospective legislation. I think it's bad, very bad. At any given moment, you ought to be able to know clearly what the law is, what your maximum liabilities are, and what the penalties are. You can give retrospective benefits, you can release an obligation retrospectively, but you shouldn't, in fact, ever impose an obligation retrospectively. So when you do a transaction, you ought to be able to say, this is the amount of tax for which I'm liable, I know what I've got to pay, and that's that. It's quite wrong, I believe, to impose a tax retrospectively, and wherever it occurs, we have in fact fought it. And the next point he gave is quite fundamental Conservative policy. Freedom of choice for the individual. And it's part of what I was dealing with in my speech, the balance within society, because the more you give bureaucrats and governments the power of saying what shall happen, the less choice you leave to the people. And if you leave people less and less choice and decisions to make about their own lives, where their own children shall go to school, their own homes, etc., their own pensions, where they shall have private health beds or not, or how they shall spend their money, you'll very quickly get a people not able to make decisions for themselves. And that, of course, would not be the Britain we've known. But although there is a case for such a bill, we haven't got provision for that kind of thing in our constitution. And I do urge again, the only real safeguard is to return a party which believes in those things. Now, did you all hear that question? I asked about common market and attitude towards the referendum. Well, first can I say that Jim Spicer is going to represent Britain in the European Parliament, and I'm sure you'll be very glad, and I'm very pleased too. Clearly this constituency did a very good job when it returned him to Parliament with a very good majority, a slightly increased one, I think, in October over February. And I'm sure you'll be very happy that he's not only going to represent you in this Parliament, but he's going to make certain that the voice of this part of the country is heard in the European Parliament. Now, as far as a referendum is concerned, we haven't in fact begun to argue the case for a referendum at all. If one is going to have one, it could be said it would be better to start with a much simpler issue rather than a rather complex one like the common market. The view we shall take is, I think, this, that we don't like referenda constitutionally. We feel that we're returned to Parliament to take these decisions, and we shouldn't, in fact, pass them back to someone else. See, if you're going to do that frequently, well, Parliament will become a fundamentally different kind of institution. Now, we therefore shall fight it on the white paper and on second reading, fight the principle of the referendum. After that, once it's decided that one is going to be held, it would seem that we shall try to make it as good as possible, do our level best to secure the result we want, because we take the view that it would be catastrophic if Britain were just to become a lonely offshore island off the coast of Europe, outside the common market, without access on the same terms to her markets. But we shall then try, I think, to get it through as soon as possible, commensurate with improving the bill, because uncertainty is bad. It's bad for farming, it's bad for business, it's bad for trade. So that, broadly speaking, is the view we take upon those issues.
Mr. Thatcher, I'm self-employed and I operate small business. Like others in the same position, I'm utterly fed up with bureaucratic interference and increasing taxation. Personally, I believe this country is more bitterly divided now than at any time since 1642. The problem now, as then, is the present taxation. I think the real problem in Parliament is that the social majority in the House of Commons enables the full notice through any measures wish. And I believe that if they complete their term in office, they will destroy the Conservative Party and its grassroots. I personally doubt that Parliament and the opposition itself can stop the march of events. Is it not time that the Conservative Party took a leap out of socialist thought by actively encouraging a Conservative equivalent of the TUC? It would be unfair to expect a quick answer to my question, but I believe that it is possibly the only possible solution in the present circumstances and that it should be carefully considered.
Well, your best friend wouldn't call you an optimist. I think you should be a little bit more optimistic than that, or have a little bit more faith in the Conservative opposition. We're making our voice heard very much now, and you can, as an opposition, have an influence on public opinion by saying the things which public opinion is feeling and want said and want done. And never forget, you know, you can ultimately upset a government by winning by-election after by-election. And they haven't got that big a majority. They've got quite a good majority over us, but not a good overall majority. So if we got some by-elections in marginal seats and won them, we could, in fact, very soon overturn some of their legislation. But I agree that at the moment we can't, because they have a majority. The only thing we can do is by argument and protest and lobbying and making them fully appreciate the consequences of their acts upon jobs. And if in fact they go on attacking small businesses, the effect will be felt on those who work for small businesses, because it's some of those jobs that will go, and therefore the tax can hit in a very, very wide way. So I hope you'll go out of the meeting a little bit more of an optimist tonight than you came in. Now, I agree that socialist governments tend to increase taxation. It's again one of the differences between conservatives and socialists. We reduce taxation when they increase it. Again, it's an example of them putting more power into the hands of the state, we leaving more in the hands of the people or in the hands of the individual. Again, a very, very important thing. Now, about forming a TUC, an answer to the TUC, I don't see very much possibility of that, but I am glad that organisations like the Small Businesses Association, like the Chambers of Commerce, like the CBI, really are making their voice heard now. They're not sitting back doing nothing. They are having their mass meetings, their protests, they're getting the television there, they're getting the radio there, they're going along to number 10 and saying this won't do, they're going along to Wedgwood Ben and saying you won't do either. and if they go on like this, they're doing quite well. So you go on attacking the present government and we'll help. And together, we hope we'll win. Thank you very much. I hope you'll get together with the previous questioner. Now, look, you win elections and you win over the powers of darkness by having your own faith, by putting it clearly, by putting it enthusiastically, by standing up and being counted. And by trying to point out the consequences of what happens if an extreme left-wing government got into this country. You cannot win without a message. And this is what I meant when earlier in the week I said, where there is no vision, the people shall perish. We have to have a clear message, a clear vision of the Great Britain we want to create. Now, I know that there are, and the House of Lords debated this week, a number of militants and very powerful groups in society. I believe they are a tiny minority, and that the fundamental body of this country has spirit, wants to do a good day's work for a good day's pay, wants to see people treated fairly, equitably and with justice, wants to see incentives for workers and not incentives for idleness, wants to save and wants to be reasonably thrifty, in other words, wants to build a good, free society of responsible citizens. Now, we shall only win over the others by putting our message and putting it again and again. And I think with the help of the last questioner, we shall do it.
Mr. Chairman, what is the key big problem with dealing with unions?
Trust a woman to come out with a $64,000 question. Yes, just remember this. We would never win as a government unless we got the votes of a large number of members of unions who quietly believe in the Conservative cause and in our way of life. Now, I think that by the time we get back in, things will perhaps be rather different from what they are today, because I think there are very, very rough economic waters ahead. There is undoubtedly, the amount of trade is reducing at the moment. It's likely that production in this country will not increase this year, and we shall be going through a difficult time. We can only, we call it, deal with people by talking to them, by trying, in fact, to mobilize the majority of your members of your union to be active in electing the leaders of their own union, and not lethargic. Because this ultimately is the real trouble. The majority are not as active as the fanatical minority. Now, that really is the key to what we have to do before and after the next election.
Mrs. Thatcher has time for one more question, please. This must be the last one.
Mrs. Thatcher, this is a question about the interaction of inflation and taxation. Taxation we can cope with without inflation. But as inflation grinds us against the ceiling of taxation, we are all being extinguished. Does any form of indexation of taxation form part of thinking of the shadow cabinet now? Because the pressure and the ceiling of taxation advance in step with the failure of inflation.
We have, in fact, two amendments down on indexing the taxation thresholds. They were probing amendments and amendments to discuss the general position, because I think none of us has done a sufficiently deep analysis of what would happen if you indexed all the threshold rates, which is what you're asking for. This, of course, is partly the Milton Friedman school, and he would say it has been done in South America. South America at the moment, or parts of it, are back to some of their higher rates of inflation, 30% and so on, so it isn't always an answer. I certainly think that you cannot leave the thresholds where they are in face of inflation, because that is just to impose an ever-increasing burden of taxation. So you've got to adjust them each year or every other year to take into account the effects. How far you adjust them depends on other things as well. First, on the level of government expenditure, and that, although the national income isn't rising very much and will not rise very much, we believe in real terms this year, is going up and up. And it also depends on the amount of money you're borrowing. And I think there are two very difficult things which we might inherit. First, a very high rate of government expenditure. Secondly, socialist governments always borrow other people's money and tend to leave it to the next government to repay. Well, that's what happened last time. When we came in 1970, we had a massive amount of debt to repay. This year, the debt is even greater. So the extent to which you can index also depends upon your policy on those two things. But I'd be misleading you if I were to give you an easy, ready, quick answer, yes, we'll index, because none of us have done a sufficiently deep analysis of it. But we're aware that you can't leave the thresholds unchanged in the face of inflation. Finally, the really big thing is to destroy inflation before it destroys us.
Chairman of this constituency, to propose the vote of thanks.
Thatcher, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, may I add my voice to what Jim Spicer said and thank our Women's Advisory Committee for letting us make use of this function this evening to widen it out to an association affair rather than a private one for themselves. Jim referred to the Albert Hall. I think we had the Albert Hall here. We could have filled it this evening. And probably charged for admission. Mrs. Thatcher, we've listened to you this evening with, I think, more than even the usual interest that the leader of the party would be accorded. Under your leadership, our expectations are very high indeed. Mm-hmm. You've been through what must have been a very unpleasant period of election. And I think after what has happened, whatever the result might have been, the party was very much looking for a new start. It's obvious that we're going to get that sort of new start. It's the sort of thing that we're going to be looking for now is not only leadership, but direction for the party. Now, you've heard Mrs. Thatcher this evening, I think, extending the sort of theme that she was starting on last week in Scotland. It's not enough for the party merely to react to events. We've got to have positive policies. We've got to have policies that are based on principle. And we've got to have policies that we develop against the background of a great industrial nation in the second half of the 20th century, against people's rising expectations, some of which are not going to be able to be met, and against the background of the welfare state. This is going to be very, very difficult indeed, but it's only by doing this that the Conservative Party is going to be able to offer the positive alternative to the woolly-minded socialism of labour that we so desperately need in this country. I think this is what Mrs. Thatcher can talk to us about this evening. The leader of the opposition has got at least three jobs. She probably knows a great many more, but at least three jobs that appear to all of us. First of all, she's got to lead the parliamentary party. Well, we've all seen how very, very effective this opposition has been so far in this parliament. When did an opposition ever achieve as much in committee against the finance bill as this one has done? We expect that to continue, and I'm quite sure that under Mrs. Thatcher's leadership it will continue. Secondly, she's got to lead the party in the country. Now this, again, is no simple matter. She's obviously going to do it by giving up her private life altogether and spending every weekend travelling around the country talking to people like us. Thirdly, she's got a plan for the future. And this, I suppose, is the most difficult thing of all. She's got an excellent group of people around her to assist in this. She will increase the size of that group with the passage of time. But this, you know, in my view, is the most difficult part of the leader of the opposition's job at a time like this. Any one of these things would be more than a full-time job for any normal able-bodied person. How you can manage three of them, I don't know, but obviously you're starting very well. Well, amongst all this, you found time to come and talk to us this evening, and for this we're all very grateful indeed. Not only those of us who are here tonight, but the many, many hundreds of people who would like to have been here tonight and can't. Mrs. Thatcher, thank you very, very much indeed on behalf of the West Dorset Conservative Association.
May I just say thank you. Thank you very much. Is this thing on? Thank you very much, Mr. Stevens. It's been a great pleasure to come and talk to you this evening. If my task every Friday evening and every weekend is as pleasant as this, I should be a very happy person indeed. We've just made a start, and I'm reminded of what my father taught me. I was just trying to write down the doggerel. It's easy to be a starter, but are you a sticker too? It's easy enough to begin a job, it's harder to see it through. Well now, with your help, and Jim Spicer's help in Parliament, we'll see it through. Thank you.
Particularly Peter Stevens and Hugh Muir, who I think must be... Okay.